Mackenzie!
Lamar!
Don't let me go, Mackenzie!
Oh my god.
Don't let me go! Oh, anyway, spoilers. We'll get there. We're covering Interstellar this week, a movie all about space exploration and father-daughter relationships, I guess, are the two big themes.
There's yeah. some themes. Yeah, we'll get into
there's
it.
There's themes. I wanted to know, let's just keep this real simple this week. This movie obviously goes to a million different places out of our reach, but do you have a favorite planet? And I'm going to limit it to ones within our solar system. None of these ones that are way, way far away.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, of course, I have to have like a weird answer to this, but Pluto, I feel really bad
oh
for
my
Pluto.
God, the controversy.
You know,
yeah.
I think it's nonsense. When I was a kid, Pluto was a planet still, and we did Pluto a little bit dirty. So, you know, now it's a dwarf planet. I feel bad for it. I don't know. I have to go for the underdog here.
Was it
Pluto.
Purely because of its size? Is that why they, or was it like, why was it disqualified?
Well, it kind of went back and forth if I recall correctly, but it was partially the size. And I think it's okay. also supposed to be, has to do with its own gravity as well. So I think it's like, it has to meet certain multiple characteristics now to be considered a planet. And they just reclassified all their measurements of planets. And eventually it fell under the minimum to be a planet.
Feels like a very like political move of like, we're going to slowly decrease this until Pluto's not a planet anymore.
And I even actually went to a planetarium recently. Cause of course I did. Sorry. And there was like a timeline on the wall of like, Pluto's a planet. And it's like this stretch. And then later it's like, not anymore. And I was like, oh, poor Pluto. Anyway, so yeah, I don't know. I'm going to go Pluto. I know it like kind of doesn't count, but that would be my pick.
But so for the record, sorry to take the low hanging fruit here, but science itself is on the record that size does matter. Throwing that out
oh
there.
Oh my God.
I know. There's like half of you are rolling your eyes and half of you are kind of chuckling. I know that that's a hit or miss joke. Anyway, for me, I feel like I feel the same way about our planet as I do about our country. It's the greatest one in the fucking universe. So I would say Earth is my favorite, obviously.
Wow.
I'm a big fan. Like, you ever read Watchmen or seen the movie?
I saw the movie, yeah.
I like the logic that humans, we're so exclusionary that everyone wants to hate a different group. And we're going through that right now of like, oh, well, I got to America 50 years ago, so I'm better than people that are coming to America now. And it's just right. like every group hates every other, like you have to feel better than something. But I like in Watchmen and other media like War of the Worlds where it's, oh, but when there's a bigger threat outside of the planet, suddenly all humans are on the same team. And it's like, yeah, we get along now. So I like that logic that eventually we're all Earthists. So then it's okay to come together. But then once the aliens are fucked off, it's back to hating each other, right?
Yeah, I think that's the norm. You know, it's nothing unifies like a common enemy. That's for sure. For sure.
Nothing gets
apparently
people hyped up, like,
aliens are the enemy, which I think is silly, to be honest.
Independence Day. That's a movie we should do. We should do that on July 4th next year.
We should do Independence Day. That is a good one. That is a good one. All right, well, we hope these choices weren't controversial, but tell us your favorite planet at some point. I'm curious. Now I
if they are controversial, if mine is controversial, then you're whatever patriotic is in terms of planet that you live on. So you're anti that.
Plantiotic? I don't know.
Yeah.
What would that be? That's, yeah.
Just rep Earth. Like, be more excited about living on Earth. You're here. Live it up, baby.
Get your shit together. All right, let's roll. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie.
I'm Lamar.
And friendly reminder that we are still in November, which is our month of all things Christopher Nolan. So we are continuing
on. This
has
been a lot more like, I didn't know I was going to be this hyped for this month. When we decided on Nolan, I was like, you know, I like Christopher. I got no problem with him. And then we've sat through four really good movies. And I'm like, okay, I kind of like Christopher Nolan a lot.
Kind of a fan. Yeah, for sure. He did, again, just banger after banger. He just cranks them out. So we are continuing with one that people do really like, but it is very complicated. So people also struggle with it, I think. Interstellar. So
I liked it better on a second watch. I liked it the first time.
Oh, this was only your second time?
Only my second time. I watched it for the first time maybe 2 years ago. And I enjoyed it, but definitely better the second time around, where I knew I could appreciate the visuals and some of the performances a little more when I wasn't busy.
Because you're not as confused. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's fair feedback. We'll get into it and we'll give a spoiler warning and all the things, because there are lots of spoilers in this one that will absolutely impact your understanding of the plot. So before we get into all that, though, what are we drinking?
We are drinking from, as always, at Craft World, minus the vowels with a period in between. Find them on Instagram. Give them a follow. This is called Murphy's Law, based on Murph in the movie, and they constantly reference it. And eventually we will come around at the end to everything that can happen will happen. And this is 2 ounces of mezcal, half an ounce each of creme de cassis, that's a blackberry liqueur, peach puree, demerara syrup, and lime juice. You're gonna shake that, strain it over a big rock, and you'll have the rim lined with tahine, because, you know, Murph is a little smoky, she's a little sweet. Those are his words, not mine. So if you feel that's demeaning, blame it on at Craft World.
Cancel him, not us. Love that. All right, well, let's give it a try. I haven't tried it. You said it was good. Cheers.
I enjoy it. Cheers. I thought when I was mixing it up, I went, that's a lot of sweet, because I had put in the blackberry, I had put in the peach puree, and then I saw the thickness of that syrup going in there, and I went, this might be even too sweet for me, but honestly, it's the mezcal.
Very balanced. Yeah. I will also say it's black currant, technically, so it's not quite as sweet as straight up blackberry. So
okay.
I think that makes a difference. Yeah, but it's delicious. Yeah, I love it. All right, homies, let's knock out some basics, and then we'll do a spoiler warning, and we'll get into the science only, just kidding, of this movie.
We were joking before this, about Mackenzie. Let's pump the brakes. We're not going to spend 90 minutes going over the science.
I have to rein you in. We hadn't even started, and he's like, calm down. Okay, I promise not to do that this time.
I'm waiting for the 3 books you have as visual props off to the side right now. You're going to be like, actually, this book, yeah.
Actually, I brought no book props, but I did bring earring props. I did bring very some nice. Like spacey earring props. I have better ones, actually, and I just couldn't find them. But anyways, these will do. All right, kids. Interstellar 2014. This is an 8.7 out of 10 for IMDb and a 73% from critics and 87% from audiences. I was a little surprised by the critics here, mostly because saying like 25%-ish, 27%-ish people said, I don't think it's worth seeing. Like, I think that's kind of nonsense,
that
to be honest.
That feels like they're trying to be controversial, or maybe it's just not their type of movie. You know, I'm not usually a sci-fi guy. Maybe that's why the first time through this, I wasn't having as much fun, but the second time through, for sure.
Yeah, we should have made them watch it twice. All right, so as we said, Christopher Nolan's our director here. We've said 1,200 things that he's done. Oppenheimer, Dunkirk, Batman's, all the things. He is also one of our screenplay writers here, but primarily written by Jonathan Nolan, who was, fun fact, actually on this film before Christopher Nolan was, when this was originally going to be done by Steven Spielberg, which I think would have radically changed the vibe, though. Yeah, I mean,
but I feel like basically if you throw this script and just the synopsis in front of me, my first guess would be, oh, this is a Spielberg movie for sure.
But the original script, I will say, this script is way better, I think, because the original script that Spielberg had, there are several major plot differences that I think would have made it worse.
It's like the Goonies, like, it's kids, they go to space.
Like a whole thing. I think it worked out as it should have. But yes, I think the vibe would have been radically different. But he dropped out for some other projects, and Jonathan, being a bro, requested that Christopher Nolan step in, which I think worked out for everybody.
I found this thing, this little fact about Christopher Nolan this week. This is our last week in November, right? It was the fourth one. So in 2023, Rotten Tomatoes, and this either, you know, proves or invalidates your point of like questionable stuff on Rotten Tomatoes of like how much stock should you put in that. But in 2023, Rotten Tomatoes ran like a user survey, and people voted, and Christopher Nolan was deemed the best director of the last 25 years, which I think you could make a really good case for that. I think there's probably three or four other potentials, but he's definitely in the running. But the thing to me that made it silly was that in addition to that, they voted on the best movies of the past 25 years from 2023 before. And all the top three were Christopher Nolan movies. And that's where I'm like, well, that's just showing the kind of people that hang out on Rotten Tomatoes. Because it was The Dark Knight, number one, not in my top probably three of the last 25 years. I mean, it's really, really fucking good. We covered it, but yes, not all the way up there. And then it's Inception and then Interstellar. Those are the best three movies of 1998 to 2023. And that, I think, takes away a bit from that poll. But kudos to him for the director win.
They got a little bit of a bias there towards Christopher Nolan, obviously. Well, you know, but he's good. I agree, though. All three of those in the top. Yeah, I don't know about all that. Also, he's made better by, again, his wife, our producer, Emma Thomas, who's done several things, including Oppenheimer with him as well, Tenet, Inception, so on and so forth. So want to get through this major cast and crew, which is actually pretty big for how much time we spend with just a couple of them, but they do all have like pretty impactful roles here. So I'm gonna shout out several. So we got obviously Matthew McConaughey plays Cooper.
Close your eyes and smell McConaughey right now. Do your best. It's so impossible. No matter how many times we do Matthew McConaughey movies, I try to write down his name by memory and I can never remember how to spell his fucking name.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Okay. McConaughey.
I think you got it. I'm pretty sure you got that. That's impressive. I would not, even today, I wouldn't be able to do that.
I have to think about it. It's just, it's not easy for sure. But anyways, yeah, he's done quite a few things. Dallas Buyers Club, we've talked about before. Magic Mike, which I think is hilarious. Mud. So, you know, this guy's got some range. We'll give him that. We've got some range. But one thing I will say about this is like, I just see some of the, you know, the definitely like the McConaughey vibes in this movie. You can like get, you know, some of like, that's just Matthew McConaughey, right? Like, that's just him being him, right? You know?
Yeah, he's doing everything he can to be at like an 8 instead of a 10. Yeah. And I think he crushes it. But yeah, you can definitely see when it's like he starts to come out a little bit to his tendencies.
Just in there. Yeah, exactly. Anne Hathaway plays Dr. Brand. She's in Les Mis, Rachel Getting Married. She's done. Obviously, she's also in Dark Knight Rises, which we didn't get to cover, but is another Christopher Nolan.
Also prefers to be called Annie, which is like not her stage name. Every credit, she's Anne Hathaway, but apparently once everybody on set, the only person she says calls her Anne is her mother when she is angry at her. So,
which like,
well, then why don't you just go by Annie Hathaway?
I mean, I get it. Flow. Maybe it's just like classy, feels classy and more adult. Like I get that. People used to call me Kenzie and I don't, you know, I kind of adopted it because there was another girl in school who had a similar nickname. She spelled her name wrong. That's fine. She's silly. But they would call us both that because it was just easy, low-hanging fruit. And as I like got older, I just thought it sounded kind of childish. Like, I didn't really like it. It sounded like a little kid name, not an adult name. So I wonder if it's that.
I think the oldest you get is like a girl in a sorority. That's like right. Kenzie.
I think that's what I'm saying.
After 21, you're no longer Kenzie.
After college, you got to stop calling me that. You know what I mean? So I wonder if it's that is what I'm saying. The Anne and the Annie of it all. So, but speaking of Mackenzies, by the way, there's a Mackenzie fucking boy in this. And she spells it right. Speaking of spelling it right, she spells it right. And she plays our kid Merv. She's so good in this. She's been in Twilight Saga. I think we've talked about that before, actually. And then The Conjuring, she's also been in. But I sort of forgot that she was in that. And then Jessica Chastain, who, like, obviously I'm obsessed with. She plays adult Merv. And she's been in a million things that we love. Zero Dark Thirty, Crimson Peak we've done, obviously. And then Ellen Burstyn rounds us out with our oldest version of Merv. She's done a ton of things. Requiem for a Dream, The Exorcist. And yeah, she's great in this as well.
Like the original Exorcist?
I think so. I think she's younger in it, though. I can't remember who she is in that one.
Is she the mom? That would be. I mean, by the time she did Requiem, she was probably in her 50s, so that would track. That's interesting. Okay, I didn't know that.
I think she's must be the mom, right? Yeah, I don't know. Okay. Bill Irwin, who I think he's only a voice in this one, but boy, is he a character. He plays
Tars. My favorite part of the movie, hands
down. He's so good. He's so good. So good. Their interaction, their bond, so good. He's also in Rachel Getting Married, so I thought that was worth mentioning. And then he also did the Jim Carrey version of The Grinch. And he's like the dad.
I saw that. So yeah, the thing I saw that perked my ears and eyes up was that he's a recurring character on Sesame Street. I think he's mostly associated with Elmo, like he does Mr. Noodle. He's one of the live action characters, not a puppet. And I just thought that was interesting. He's been doing it for going on 20-something years. So Good for you.
Old Sesame Street. Yeah. All right, Michael Caine plays Professor Brand. We've talked about him before, done every Christopher Nolan ever practically. Youth is another one that he was in that was great. Secondhand Lions is actually one that I haven't mentioned that one yet, and I think it's really good. If you haven't seen it, it's very, very heartwarming. And then Timothée Chalamet makes an appearance here. He plays Tom, the other kiddo of Cooper. He just recently did A Complete Unknown, and if you haven't seen it, you should see it. It's really incredible. And then he also did Call Me By Your Name, which I think is also really incredible, despite the Army Hammer of it all, because he's the worst. And then we have David Gassi, who plays Romilly, and he is recently in The Diplomat, which is like a Netflix series. And if you haven't seen it, it's actually really good. And Maleficent, he was in terms of films as well. And then we have several more.
Keep it going.
More that I'm actually not going to give you their resumes because they're not, there's, it's going to take us half.
Can I just call out one? God. And that's Wes Bentley as Doyle, only because not only is he the plastic bag kid from American Beauty, but he's Seneca in the Hunger Games with the crazy ass facial hair. I was like, where do I know this guy from? And he had the crazy flame facial hair. I'm done.
No, that's fine. He was on the list. Don't worry. But we also have John Lithgow, Casey Affleck, Matt Damon, Topher Grace, who needs to calm the fuck down, and David Oyelowo. So, like, we have, and there are others, but those are all ones who, like, kind of make an impact but aren't in it that long. It's a huge cast. It's pretty wild. So, and it's kind of a departure from some of his regular troop of players that we've talked about before. He's got a couple in here, but mostly new. So, that's kind of fun. All right, quick plot summary that is spoiler free, and then later we're going to do another one that I think is more fun. But this one is, when Earth becomes uninhabitable in the future, a farmer and ex-NASA pilot, Joseph Cooper, is tasked to pilot a spacecraft along with a team of researchers to find a new planet for humans.
It's accurate. I would get rid of in the future. That feels a little redundant, when Earth becomes uninhabitable. In the future, that's when they send. You can just say when it becomes uninhabitable. Journalism. I took some journalism classes in college, so.
Oh, we're getting nitpicky here. Okay, I do, however, agree that we could trim the fat there. I'm with that. Yeah. I'm with that. Our composer here is Hans Zimmer. I meant to mention, who has done a couple of these. So good, to be honest. Like, there are several kind of Easter eggs even in the score. And it's really beautifully done. So another producer I wanted to call out who actually helps Emma Thomas this time, though, I think is a really interesting overlap, is Linda Obst, who did Contact, which one is Matthew McConaughey is in Contact as well. And two, our other producer or advisor rather on the production was Dr. Kip Thorne, who was on this as well and ended up writing a book about the science. It's literally called The Science of Interstellar. And he advised on both, and they both did both. So I thought that was kind of cool. We've got
a famous nerdy overlap, right?
Yeah.
Like, he a character in, what was the Stephen Hawking movie?
Theory of Everything.
I feel like he's in character.
As a person with whom Stephen Hawking interacts. Yeah.
So his science is what kind of led to both of these. I like the, sometimes as I didn't know that until after I'd seen the movie the second time, but I wrote down, I was like, the science in this is really interesting. I don't know if this is all real or not. And then it kind of turns out it is based in theory, but on how things should actually work, you know?
Yeah. I mean, he advocated pretty hard with, not even advocated, like his agreement with Christopher Nolan in order to advise on the film was that they weren't going to make up any science. Basically, it was like, it has to be rooted in what is currently discovered science and mathematics. And we're not going to make something else up at the whimsy of the screenwriter or the director. And so everything had to be rooted in something that has already been analyzed, discovered, etc., in terms of what they were displaying on the screen. So they were like, there are going to be things that we won't be able to explain to make the story work, but we're not going to assert science where there is none. So we'll get into later where that becomes relevant, but I thought that was really fascinating. He had to talk Christopher Nolan out of traveling faster than the speed of light at one point because of this. he was like, nah, man, I told you no. And they fought about it for apparently like 2 weeks.
We've been over this.
Exactly. Anyway, so it's really fascinating. This, you know, despite how complicated it is, did very well in theaters. This was a $165 million budget, which is a little bit less than Batman, but I get that because it's like not a Batman movie. And it made $769.1 million. So like creeping up on a billion with a B, that's pretty solid. Pretty solid. All right, kids. I think it's time. Is it time? Do we feel like it's time?
I think it's time.
All right. Turn around. Don't drown. It's spoiler time.
Before we get into the story, I want to know one thing. Give me one word to describe this movie. Give me an adjective.
There are so many options, and yet I cannot choose.
Do you want mine while you're thinking?
Yeah. Hit me with yours.
I just wrote down in my notes, in a word, breathtaking. Like, this movie to watch is just visually just stunning. So that would be mine, is breathtaking.
I like stunning, actually, that you just said. I like stunning. I think it's, yes, it's beautiful. I mean, it's beautiful in all the ways, you know, visually, the story, the theme, the themes, plural, the music, you know, it's just stunning. Yeah. I think that's a good one.
What was it, last week or 2 weeks ago, where we were talking about his love for just cinema and wanting to make films intentionally with the movie theater experience in mind? And I think this is the one where it is clearest that, like, you really ought, I ought to have seen this in the theater, and I didn't. But when you just listen to the sound and everything and see what's on screen, I'm just like, in this in IMAX, what I can only imagine.
It was so fucking good. And the black hole thing, that was just like, bananas cool. Okay, before we get into it, I want to give you, as a framework, so what we're gonna go over is fundamentally pretty complicated. Like, this story is pretty complicated. We're gonna keep it as simple as possible, don't get me wrong, but I thought this other summary might help us frame that up really well. And I was trying to look for a more robust summary than the IMDb one, and so I went to Reddit and I was like, there's got to be a good summary there. This is not the most detailed or helpful summary in terms of the overall, like, all the things you're trying to solve for, but it is the funniest. So here we go. The world is dusty. Corn is life. Someone poked a hole in space. 12 people went in the hole to look for a new planet where there's more than corn and dust. 4 more people and 2 robots go through the hole to check on a couple of those 12 to see what's best. Michael Caine is a liar. Matt Damon is a liar. It's impossible / necessary. Matthew McConaughey falls into a black hole. Gravity travels through dimensions and time because love, Tars, love. And temporal causality loop. And Hathaway mothers 1,300 children on the more than corn and dust planet. The end.
I think we're done here. We could pack it up. Let's call this an episode. Yeah.
I thought it was good.
Wait, can you give credit to that Reddit poster? I need to.
Yes, we absolutely will. Yeah. So this was on a thread where somebody said, please explain this to me like I'm a 5-year-old. I tried so hard to solve this while I was watching it. Please explain this to me like I was a 5-year-old. There was a really good one. And then there was this one done by Green Man Glass.
Well done.
And it's
sir.
A couple years old.
I would have just gone with hilarious. If I had to add to that, I would just say, ghosts are real, aliens are real, but we are the ghosts and aliens. That's my shorthand version. Like, it's us. The whole time, it's us. I do like that. To wrap it all back into the story, I like how at the beginning of this, like we've talked about with other Nolan films, you have no fucking idea. You know the basics of what's happening. We have a traditional, like, I'm a big sucker for a big dystopian story, whether it's a novel or a film, and they set you up pretty quick with that. But when we start getting the question marks of like, okay, wait, so I get that the world is burning down and it's, you know, going to go extinct or not be habitable by humans. What the fuck is up with this ghost thing? And oh my God, what's up with this space, this wormhole? Mm-hmm. Like, it feels like you don't have all the answers, but I just enjoy how they start out with that craziness and eventually you start getting those answers back.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's really fascinating is the framework of, I mean, yes, the blight is a disease, like a crop killing disease that's taking over the planet. And this is actually based not that far into the future. 2067 is where we start. And basically, they're going to eventually starve to death, or they will suffocate to death because of the dust and or the lack of crops, lack of anything to eat. So he obviously is trying to take care of his kids. His kids are there, and you start to see the ghost thing like you're talking about, and these things, these weird things start to happen. And what I love about the beginning is the way he forces her to think about it in scientific terms. Like, she's just calling this thing a ghost as a nickname, and she's not doing that to be silly. She just doesn't know what else to call it, right? Mm-hmm. And he takes her out of it and says, like, don't just assert a claim. Like, track it, identify it, understand the data, explain the science of it. Like, something is happening here that you need to solve. And I think, honestly, that conversation becomes the impetus for the rest of the movie. Like, it's no argument that she's brilliant. She was already a smart kid. She already was taken after her dad. But this desire to solve this and to need to solve this really is framed up at the very beginning and from a very young age for her. And it becomes her literal life mission, just like her dad. And I think it's a really cool bond that holds up and is the through line throughout the whole film.
For a movie that is literally, the stakes are as high as they can be as far as humanity is concerned, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's literally everyone on the planet could die and the entire human species could die. The stakes have never been higher for humans. But somehow this movie makes the most important thing a father-daughter dynamic, and how much this guy cares about his daughter and her feeling betrayed by him. And I just think that's really a tough line to walk when you're trying to get us to care about this while there's all this other shit going on. But yeah, I do love how it all, they are the backbone of the story, which is weird to say because I feel bad for Tom, who, he's not an afterthought, but like, you understand why he's pissed later in the film, right? Because it does feel like Murph and Coop, their relationship is the pivotal part of the story.
They just relate to each other the best, you know? And I think that's why it hurts her the most too, mm-hmm. right? Like, you're my person, you're my anchor, and you're leaving me, you know, and you're leaving me at a pivotal moment. And you can't help but feel for her, because while he is telling her that he wants to go solve this problem for humanity, you cannot help, especially at that age and as a kid, to feel like, yeah, but you're leaving me, you know, you're choosing everything and everyone else over me. And we also, I think, have to acknowledge the dichotomy there of, he is kind of choosing for him too, right? At his core, at his root, he's an explorer. We see that throughout. He wants to see what's next. He wants to know where we're going. He wants to go into space. Like, that is who he was meant to be. That who he feels he is meant to be. And I think it plays out, right? It plays out that that is true. That is his destiny. But it does mean choosing that over his daughter and his children. And I think it's the hardest thing that he does. He plays it very well, where you feel so much pain for him to make that choice. And it is rooted, obviously, in love for them as well. And you see that just struggle. And that's where I think, like, I'm joking about the Matthew McConaughey of it all. He does really give a strong performance of how hard this would be as a parent to do this.
He's great. I don't think there's a bad performance in this period. I think literally everyone we listed at the start crushes it.
Topher Grace.
To be fair, they should have just named him Topher and I would have no problem with it if he was just
playing
himself.
But like, he's like at 1,000 at multiple points. And I'm like, hey, can we bring it down like 3 notches, dude? You're taking me out of this. It was every time I was like, okay, I literally have in my notes, excessive Topher Grace, like not his character's name, just Topher, calm down. But no, I think I agree generally. They're all really strong performances. Yeah.
Joe Bob Briggs, the guy that we went to a horror movie marathon of his, but he hosts like movies. He's been doing it since like the 90s on TBS, but he does them on Shudder now. And he does movie stats at the start of every movie. And anytime there is something like what you're talking about, he describes it as gratuitous. So this would be gratuitous Topher Grace. It's just him going at 1,000. And it's like, we don't necessarily need this in the movie, but sure, we'll take it.
It is too much. I think though, like what we anchor around are a few things in this film. I think it's stunning. Like we said, the visuals, the sound, all the thing, the way that it is produced and shot and all the allusions to time, even in the set design and the ship design and all these things. There's these recurring physical themes, these themes in sound, etc., that are really strong. but then your other theme is the science of it all. And then I think the other, which is compelling and very well thought out and extrapolated out. But then I think you also have the intangible of it all, which I think is presented in a really interesting way here, to your point of like the ghost and her trying to figure out this ghost is that intangible, not only science, but that theme of love, you know, of this thing that can be interdimensional and becomes such a core theme. And I wanted to ask you, because I was reading about this yesterday and today, and there were really strong reactions about that being a core theme. Like, I don't think there's any argument that it is. And it was like, it takes away from the science. It takes away from everything. Like, what a reach to make this last thing that is, you know, can cross dimensions and motivate humanity is love to solve this. What is your take on that? Do you think it takes away from the movie? Do you think it complements everything really well? Like, what are your thoughts?
It's not my favorite. I don't think Nolan is not M. Night Shyamalan. Not every one of his movies has a twist or something like that. But of the ones that do, it's not my favorite when we get to the end. I don't hate it. But like the whole, he was the ghost all along and he's the one who like every, but to what we said when we described our drink, like everything that can happen will happen. And even Brandt says at some point, the one thing time can't do is go backwards and like you can't rewrite it. But if the theory here is to quote the television show Lost, you know, everything that happened happened. So this whole circle of him going through this wormhole, going into this black hole, getting spit out and like helping out himself find it in the past. It's a lot to wrap your head around and it seems a little hokey, but I think I don't want to jump too far forward to the end. The emotion with which he delivers it when he is watching from the other side of the bookshelf, I think makes it a lot more palatable. But I could see how some people would be like, we wanted aliens or we wanted this bigger force, or but it turns out it's just human love. That feels very Spielberg to me, but I'm fine with it. I'm not going to like get upset over it.
I think it permeates all the relationships too. I mean, we get, you know, Brand and her relationship with Edmund is a core theme. Professor Brand and his love of humanity, but also his daughter is a core theme. Murphy's relationship with her family. Like, I just think it permeates the overall storytelling in so many ways that it is an interesting tie-in at the end, but I think it has been kind of like subtly happening throughout the plot.
Yeah,
is what
they
I would
hint
say.
At actually, it throughout. Yeah.
So I think it's a really strong theme. I do want to talk about like the stunning of it all, right? Like, it's just, like we said, gorgeous. It's beautifully shot, beautifully designed. It's such his aesthetic, but in a really interesting, like, I think he brings in some different styles that we haven't seen before, like capturing, for example, the farm even feels very different for him. But he did produce Man of Steel, where it had a similar environment. And he sort of replicates that here, and it becomes this anchor point for their story at the beginning and at the end. And it's subtle stuff. It's like the dust.
We talked a couple weeks ago about his love of practical effects and trying to avoid digital effects at all cost. And that's what I was like, of all the movies we've covered, even if you take the ones we haven't covered, like in Inception, I still think this was probably the biggest challenge to be like, okay, how can we do these massive? I feel like I've seen 20 other movies that do big dust clouds rolling in from the horizon, and it's always digital. So it's like, how do you make that look realistic? And he found a fucking way.
It's like a thin, literally a thin physical layer, you know, to this whole story. And it's really well done and it's subtly done. And you live in it, they move in it and they live in it in a way that makes sense, right? They're flipping their plates and they're covering their water glasses and all these things. And, you know, he planted the cornfields, like they planted those. They ended up selling them off hilariously for a profit. But he planted that to burn it, to film it, to like to have it be so tactical. And they just kind of insert you in this environment right at the beginning with Ellen Burstyn like narrating us at the top of this being a historical event. You know, they're narrating the story, they're telling you what it was like back then, which even right then is such an interesting snapshot, right? We're already kind of giving something away. It's already kind of telling everybody, there's a story to tell and there's people to watch the story, right? There's some that we're telling the story to somebody. For us to even be watching this is telling us a lot about what might happen. And I think it contributes again to like that loop, right? That loop that this story is taking kind of throughout.
Well, to that point, it mirrors at the end. I had written down, because I couldn't remember, again, this being my second watch, I wrote down, I really like at the beginning how they're weaving in these documentary pieces. I had read that was actually pulled from a Ken Burns documentary on the Dust Bowl, which makes so much sense, except for the Ellen Burstyn stuff. She was not present at the Dust Bowl.
Yeah, she's the only one.
That would be a crazy coincidence, right? If they were like, hey, we're going to use this footage from you from like 100 years ago. But...
I've seen that documentary. It's very good. But anything Ken Burns is very good. Yeah.
But I like how I wrote down, I like how they're using it at the beginning, but then I'm like, wait, it disappears and we just stop. But then it circles back at the very end and you figure out, oh, they're showing it at this sort of historical museum, basically, this replica of the house. So I like how it does come back around.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that for us, it closes like both a physical and emotional loop as the viewer in a really strong way. But I think is kind of cool and arguably a little bit symbolic is that it pulls Coop out of it again, right? Like think about that loop, think about that cyclical story that we're telling, and Coop is there and he doesn't like it. Like in theory, this is so neat. He's solved it. He's in the place. He's followed the loop. He's whatever. He's here. And he's like, I don't want to pretend that we're where we were before. Yeah. I want to see where we're going. And he slingshots himself out of that loop again. You know what I mean? He just does it again. And so I just think there's so many things happening in this film at the same time. And I think that's what's so, I love playing with both the emotional and scientific aspects of time not being linear and every single one of our characters experiencing time in a really different way. And they're together for snippets, right? They overlap each other in snippets, but at some point or another, they are all on a different timeline, every single one of them. And I think that's just a really fascinating piece of storytelling. And I think it's very Christopher Nolan to just play with these themes of times and these loop and think about the Penrose steps that we talked about before. Mm-hmm. And like, he wants to understand this and play with this energy. And I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I somebody on IMDb, credit to them, actually wrote down the chronological story of this entire film and broke it down as to what order everything happens in. And I wasn't going to regurgitate it to y'all, but it's on there. I thought it was a cool read to be like, oh, this is when this happens. This is when the time skip, and this is what's happening on the spaceship while they're down on this crazy ass planet. I don't want to, before we get to like that, because I know we got to talk about their actual exploration and when they get to these different planets and habitats. But the last thing I wanted to say about the beginning of the film is I just love, it's the rare case where I think it's exposition done well. You could tell that like Jonathan Nolan is doing his best to be like, I need to tell people about this universe we're in without spelling it out so obviously. But they do a good job of telling you what's going on with the crops. They have a couple quotes in there about there's no armies anymore. There's no MRIs. They talk about the baseball game. The Yankees are just playing on this tiny ass field in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. And they're comparing it there. And I love the quote. Oh, the last thing I was going to, the fake moon landing. I was like, wait, so in this universe, are we saying that that is, or is it?
No, but
controversial.
I think they've rewritten the textbooks, right? It is something that happened. I think what he's saying is that obviously we did that. I'm an engineer. We went to space. Like I know what we did. And they have rewritten the textbooks to deal with the repercussions of where humanity is now and refocus their efforts. I think they don't want people looking at space, right? Like, they even say that about it, that theme comes up repeatedly of like, we have to give people the option of a plan A because they're not going to ever opt in to plan B in and of itself. They're not going to spend money on that. They're not going to do that, right? So it's like, how do we build a world in which people believe X is fantastical so that we can focus on why, which is we need farmers and we need crops need to solve these very practical problems that are right in front of us. And I think he's one of the people, obviously, who's very well educated and is like, that's bullshit. Like, that's propaganda. you know.
And that's okay. I did not track that. That's a thank you for explaining that, because that's a very good explanation. I did not track that they were trying to motivate people. It's similar to what we said at the beginning of, like, you know, when aliens come up, suddenly the Earth is united. Yeah. So if you tell them we can't get off Earth and save us that way, we need to do it here and just fix climate change finally, that makes a ton of sense. I did really like the John Lithgow, the Donald quote near the beginning, when he says, you know, it back in his day, and he's explaining how it was, and he said 6 billion people and every last one of them trying to have it all. And I just thought that was such an accurate quote to where we're at right now, of just everybody wants to live above their means, everybody wants more than what they currently have. And he's like, you know, this life, it's not so bad. So I just liked that little throwaway line in the midst of all this chaos to start the film off.
Yeah, he has a very down-to-earth presence and a very grounded presence, I would say, and somebody who is wise, having learned from those things and probably experienced learning from those things himself, you know. And I loved his line actually to Cooper about, like, you were born, you know, 40 years too late or whatever it was, or maybe 50 years too early. I don't remember what he says to him. He's like, either too early or too late. Like, you were born at the wrong time for who you are and who you want to be. And it turns out, and I think, again, it's one of the many allusions to time and time being relative, it actually turns out he was born at the perfect time, and he straddles time in the most unique way to really cover decades, over a century really, in terms of time, so that he can be the right person at the right time to solve this problem. Mm-hmm. And obviously coupled with his daughter, who, like, they really did do it together. But I think that frames up the conversation really in a really interesting way that also then makes the payoff even more, you know, powerful later, of, you know, he actually was born at the right time. It just, he was a man out of time for a moment, and then he found it, and it was in this black hole, you know. And how crazy is that? So it's as scientific as this story is, like, I just don't think you can get away from the poetry of it, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's so much more to the humanity of it and the love of it and all these things that contribute to the story as much as the science does. I think you can talk about both in equal measure here.
I'd agree with that. I mean, half the motivation in this is people caring about other people, not almost caring about other people more than they care about the entire human race. Like, it's just these individual relationships they have. But on the science piece, I think when the movie really kicks into high gear, because I said earlier, Nolan gives you just enough here. It's a great example of him giving you just enough to keep you guessing, kind of like when we did Memento or The Prestige. You're not entirely sure what's happening. You're getting all these hints of things. You're trying to string it together. I think things really start coming together when you get the NASA reveal of, like, we're NASA, we're hunkered down in this thing and trying to find another plan for us to get off Earth. And then when we actually get, like, the mission going out there to try and salvage something and investigate these other planets, I think that is kind of the turning point where I'm like, oh shit, now I get what's happening.
And I think it's really interesting on a first watch, to your point, versus a later watch, because on a first watch, NASA have now become our heroes, right? Like, they're our one great hope at this point. And everybody there is working for the good of mankind in some form or another. And that's how it's presented to you. But I think on the first watch, again, like, peppered in there are all these mysteries, right? Like, this is rooted in science, of course, but, like, how did they find it? Right. And, you know, yes, obviously they get the coordinates in binary and they solve that and it's brilliant, but you're just like, what are the odds? Right. Yeah. What are the odds that you find the coordinates and you get to the exact right place? And also, what are the odds that they're like, oh, hey, we didn't even know you were alive, bro. We would love for you to pilot our ship. We need you. We need only you. You're the exact right person. And then they're just going to hire him on the spot. Right. Like, what are the odds of this? And that's where there's, I think, for a good chunk of the movie, and especially again on first watch, you are trying to solve this mystery that it feels like there is science too. So I think you're, like, emulating the experience of Murphy at the beginning of this movie. You're really in her shoes of, like, what are we solving here? There is this almost magical quality to it and this mystery to it, but there's gotta be a reason. And again, the payoff later is really powerful for that as well.
I feel like in the first time I watched this, and even halfway into this, I had kind of forgotten some of what I saw the first time. But I was almost to the science point. I almost was putting myself more in, from like a religious standpoint. I was like, I couldn't remember. I went, wait, so they keep referring to this they that is giving us these, somebody's helping us out there in the universe. And why would they do that? Why would they help humans? What do we matter? And you're thinking maybe it's like aliens or gods or something like that. So for the first half of this, yeah, it seems a little silly that there's always coincidences. Like I said, the twist, I don't think for a lot of people, that's not going to work of just, well, we did it ourselves. We somehow saved ourselves in this weird time loop wormhole scenario. But, you know,
I think if you study the science of it, it's like, I think if you like read into the science of it, it's so possible. It's so fascinating how possible
Mackenzie,
it is.
You're going to have to convince people to read in order to do that. So I don't think that's going to work.
I have so many, you joke. I have books. I didn't bring the props, but I have books that I can recommend that will help you. No, I think it's fascinating because like, I mean, really Albert Einstein was concerned, truly concerned with this exact equation problem, solving gravity and quantum mechanics. They don't solve themselves, right? And so he spent like, I think it's something like the last 50 years of his career focusing on that. And this is why there's less output from him in terms of, you know, results. And so I think it's really fascinating to think about the science that we have uncovered versus what is, again, right now it's a mystery. Right now it's magical. Right now it's almost paranormal, like whatever we want to call it, of this, it's this they, it's maybe it's aliens, maybe it's whatever. When really I think it's just unproven science. And even in this story too, right? In this story, that's actually what one of the things I really love about it is that, again, and this is probably due to you know, our Dr. Kip Thorne here, who's like, I'm not going to explain science that I can't explain, because we get to this point where we have so much of it figured out, but there's this data that we can't reach, we can't define, it can't help us solve gravity and quantum mechanics and all these things. And this tesseract thing still becomes something that is not fully solved. Like they get some key data that they need to do the things that they need to do. But you never fully understand, and I don't think you're supposed to, how this future they has helped. How did they build this? How did they establish this? How did they know to help us because of that time loop, that relative time loop kind of problem that they're solving for? And so I think it's really fascinating.
Let's go back. We'll double feature this with Terminator, because in that there's a weird time loop of like, well, he sent himself back and now he gave birth to John Connor, like, or he didn't give birth. In a perfect future, men would be giving birth. But in Terminator, you know, he impregnates Sarah. I'm not going to go through the whole plot. I don't want to spoil it for you guys. But I feel like it's another thing where the movie doesn't make sense if there's not the reality of like a time loop could exist of some capacity. You could go back and make things that don't change what happened, but literally cause the future to happen. It's very,
but yeah, it's that like causality temporal loop thing, right? Yeah. Of just like you, that future impacts the past and that past impacts that future. And that is where this like fourth dimension of time becomes critical to this story even being possible, and also accepting the premise that time is not linear and that there is a force of some kind that can cross dimensions. And I think what's cool about it is they don't fully explain that, but they acknowledge that it has to exist. And I think it's fascinating when we get to this structure and what it is, right? We get to the black hole. They've been through all the time as relative battles. They've tried these other planets. It's not working. This is the fucking Hail Mary of, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to try and get the data. And we're just going to hope that maybe this is humanity's last shot. But it's this fucking room. It's this bookshelf. It's this replicated bookshelf that can't, that is not in a linear structure either, right? It's in this imposed tesseract where the rooms fold in on themselves and you are then trapped in this space. And so once he's there, he's trapped, but he can move around it. He can impact it. Mm-hmm. And it's only built that way because of the they, right? Like you're not showing up at a random ass black hole and it's the bookshelf of your daughter's room.
Yeah. You're showing up in the place
by accident, constructed. Yeah, right? Yeah. Like they constructed this because this was a medium that you could not only impact, but that you could understand. And so I think it's a really fascinating stretch of the science where it's not expecting you to fully understand every part of it, but to get there, it relies on some actual science to end up in the black hole and be able to do this.
Yeah. But before we get to the black hole, I feel like we have to touch on three big things. First, we have to talk about each of the two major planets that they explore, because I feel like those are huge. We spend so much time on each of those places. And I love how the movie paces itself once they get into the actual spaceship and like they go out into space. Like, I think it is perfectly paced from that point on, where we spend time on this planet where time obviously moves much faster than what it is on Earth. And I think that sequence is spectacular with the giant wave. And it's just, I don't think was practical. I don't think. Maybe.
No. but that's such an incredible visual. It really is. Yeah. Like, and that it becomes, it's such a unique planet. I love I actually like the assertion that this planet would have water and it's just this small, like shallow water, but these waves can be so powerful and take over. And like, you know, it just is such a unique perspective of a totally different world. And I love that. I think that's really fascinating. I think the calculations of it all are one super complicated and confusing, but also really interesting because, I mean, if you think about it, they ended up spending way more time on there. They come back. It's been 23 years. They find out that she probably passed away minutes ago, hours ago, whatever it was, which is like, if to wrap your brain around that in and of itself is crazy. And then they get back, barely making it. Doyle doesn't make it, which another thing is like, he might just be unconscious. They could maybe still save him. And this whole time is relative thing, right? Of like, if they have solved this and gotten the space station, then can they go down there and get him? What will be for him hours later, right? So like, there's just the possibilities that it raises are kind of insane. But it, also the human impact of it, you know, like, how long ago did this woman die? In our lifetime, it's been this amount of time. And how long until we could potentially get to Doyle? And how long has Romilly been alone? And you get back up there and he's been alone for 23 years. And I think like that is such an impactful moment of you see he already had anxiety about this trip. He had a hard time with his space travel. And then he's the man who gets left alone for 23 years and he loses faith that they're ever going to come back. And like, think about that, what that does. You get snippets of this shift in the human psyche out of isolation and it becomes a recurring theme. And this is one of the moments where you start to see the little smaller impact of that, of somebody being alone for that long and what it does to you. And then it feeds us right into that next planet as well.
Right before we get there, I have to shout out. I met someone named Kristen at a Gong conference, for those of you that know the company Gong. She actually, I was telling her about the pod and we're probably going to do a Nolan month. She threw this fact at me before I even did any IMDb research, but she pointed out that on that planet, I guess the score gets really low and you hear a ticking noise. And every time you hear a ticking noise, it's about every 1.5 seconds. That's a day on Earth. So as they're there, every single tick is a day. And I just thought that was pretty interesting. So shout out, Kristen. I thought that was a pretty cool fact. But to tie into the Romilly thing, it's heartbreaking. His entire story is really rough to be stuck up there. But at least he had Tars, who we have to talk about Tars. That was number two on my list. Tars is the fucking best. I think Tars and Bill Irwin's performance of him is probably my favorite part of the movie, honestly.
I think we have to talk about a couple of things. Going back to the tick really quick. Like, I think that's one of many Easter eggs in the score, right? Like, that's one of the things that, you know, he put in the composition. And there's so many other powerful moments in the composition of the score. So I think, like, you can't overlook just listening. Just listening to what's happening, even if you closed your eyes and listened to those moments, it's a different experience. I totally agree. And then Tars, Tars becomes this anchor. He becomes this anchor to the story, to their humanity, which is hilarious because, of course, he's a robot, right? But he relates to them in such a human way and can emulate that human connection, but they can also customize it, which is what makes it such an interesting interaction with his humor and his honesty and all the things. And his trust settings. I love his trust settings later, you know, like he's hilarious. And I think that, you know, he does such a good job of playing that voice Bill Irwin does, you know, it just comes through and his humor comes through and he sounds like a human, but a robot, which I think is what they're, you know, it's exactly what they're going for. You know, it sounds really good.
One other little thing that I like in this, because we've talked about the science a lot, and I just wanted to touch on this really quickly, is I like how all of the tech and gadgets, you said this takes place in like the 2060s or something like that. It doesn't look so far advanced that it looks like a sci-fi movie. It looks like it could be modern day. Even TARS, like, I know it's a giant blocky cube running robot, but like that actually looks less advanced than the androids that have come out like this year that are in the shape of like human bodies, right? So I like
Russian
that the tech
that fell over.
Sorry again. Oh yeah,
except for that Russian one that face planted. That was fucking hilarious. Oh, but I do think that's intentional. I think that's intentional, right? Because like the point is that Earth has Earth has self-destructed, right? Yeah. Humanity has self-destructed. To Donald's earlier point, they spent so much time trying to have it all that they used it all. They took it all. They destroyed it all, which, by the way, is a lesson for us all. And I think that we are back to, again, we are restructuring and rebuilding humanity, right? Like, and I think that the technology is going to follow that cycle as well, right? We don't have all the same gadgets and gizmos aplenty because we don't have that many engineers anymore. We don't have that many people who can even create these things. We are relearning. It's like relearning tools, and we're rebuilding that technology. So I think you're supposed to see that it has actually reverted in many ways. And that is because of what we have done to ourselves and to our own technology.
Yeah. The visuals in this, the interior of the spaceships looks like what I think a spaceship would probably look like. I know that some of them are probably a little more advanced than what we have now, but like it just looks
very
real.
Similar to what NASA has now. And it checks out. You're like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Similar.
I especially like when you were talking earlier about the different, like the visuals in this, I like that Nolan in this one is using a lot of like side panel cameras on all the vehicles, whether it's the pickup truck or the spaceship. There's these shots of just, it looks like there's a camera glued to the outside of the vehicle and it's just staring down. I like that he commits to that throughout the whole film. It feels like that's his thing for this movie.
It's not as polished, and I think it's on purpose. You know, you're supposed to feel the movement of what's happening here. You're supposed to feel the breakthrough, the wormhole. You're supposed to feel the gravity on the, you know, transition into the black hole. You're supposed to feel the spin of the Endurance when he's trying to dock it. You're supposed to feel all these things because I think they contribute to the overall tension, the physical and emotional tension of this story. And I even have in my notes at one point of like this, he's just masterful in his use of tension in these key moments, and they last just the right amount of time. I mean, think about the spin, you know, like that spin of the Endurance docking spin is, it's insane. And it, but it's to your point earlier, is perfectly paced. And the wave, same thing. It's perfectly paced. And a big part of that is, to your point, how it is shot. I think it's supposed to put you in feeling that movement in a different way than we've seen in a lot of his other films.
Yeah. You were very much just along for a ride in this entire film. Once you get into the shit, it is just nonstop through there. I wanted to transition because you had brought up Romilly and his experience. And I just feel like he's got the worst hand dealt to him of everyone. He's left alone for 20 something years and then is killed shortly thereafter by this turncoat. And I think that's going to segue us into
this piece of shit.
What's Matt Damon's character's name?
Dr. Man.
And this is before or after The Martian? After, it has to be, because he dies at the end of this. So I always knew when I watched The Martian that he was a coward at heart and that eventually he would turn. And I just want to say I was right. So this being a tie-in was pretty cool.
This is the year before The Martian, and I actually love The Martians, so don't talk shit.
Oh, so Martian's a prequel to try and like earn his character cred back. Like, actually, he wasn't such a bad guy. Look, he farmed just like Coop. You like Coop. But I feel like for poor Romilly, because Doyle, meanwhile, if he is alive, to your point, on the water planet, he's just gonna, he goes to swimming for 25 minutes and then he's gonna get picked up in a better universe than he left it. But fucking Romilly, you know, dies after being stranded for 23 years. But I feel like we just have to touch on the man planet, and just, this is like riveting to watch the second time
through. This is riveting. I mean, it is, again, the master of tension and pacing and stress. And like, and again, there's just this human element to it of like, you fucking hate this guy. You know, it's such a cool, like, so I did see this in theaters, and I've seen it a bunch of times actually. So I saw it in theaters. And the fun part about this is that it cannot be understated how much of a surprise it was that this was Matt Damon, right? He wasn't promoted as a part of this movie at all. Like, he wasn't on the, he didn't do press. He had only been in one Variety article mentioned as having an unknown role like a couple years prior. Nobody knew this was going to be him. He comes out. He's also Matt fucking Damon. He's an affable guy. You know, people like him. So you have this preconceived notion of who this character is going to be. Not to mention they have teed him up as Dr. Man is the best of us, the most brilliant of us. Well, now this man has so much further to fall. And boy, does he fucking fall, right? He is the best of us. And now he is also simultaneously the worst of us. And I think you're supposed to see that, right? You're supposed to see this almost Perseus type of character who burns himself because he can't withstand the pressure at the end of the day, the isolation and the lack of human connection and the inability to see or find a person breaks him. And he's the more advanced case of Romilly. And that's not to say that Romilly would have handled it the same way. I don't mean that. I just mean, he's the more advanced case of that isolation. And you see it in his initial breakdown of seeing Coop. And
that moment is powerful. Like, when you want to like this guy at the start and you're just like, shit, like Damon nails it. I'm glad they cast such a high caliber actor for this role because it comes out of nowhere 90 minutes or so into the movie. Yeah. But does he just needs to deliver or this falls flat. And that moment is great.
And he keeps delivering. And like, you see him again, you are predisposed to liking this person, and he's explaining his life, he's explaining his planet, he's like, you are buying what he is selling, you know. Mm-hmm. And but I think, to be fair, and it's been a long time, it's obviously I saw this in 2014 for the first time, so I don't remember exactly what I thought or if I suspected him at all. I honestly don't remember, but I will say, I think you are supposed to feel this unease, right? You are supposed to feel like this is not going to play out perfectly. You don't maybe know exactly why, but that's again where I think the score comes into play. Like, there is this undercurrent, this undertone throughout that time on that planet that is somewhat ominous. It's subtle, but it's ominous. And then you get the message from Murph tearing down the whole premise of this mission. And man trying to explain that, but again, explain it from his lens of we're choosing humanity over the future of humanity over those people. And it, I think, makes you start to question his motivations. And that's the first crack, you know. You still trust him, but it's maybe the first crack because he was a part of this big lie. He was a part of this big lie that they all were sold and that they all bought.
He's trying to save all of humanity, but he's including himself in that. So he's seeing it as like the greater good. But oh, I also get to be one of the ones who's going to start this.
Yeah. I also was the first guy to hop the planet, right? So in retrospect, you go, has he been a coward the whole time? Or did isolation do this to him? Because he was a part of this plan from the beginning. He left with this answer already, that plan B was the answer and that people just needed to basically fucking meet him there, right? So was he always a coward? Was he the first, was he Cal on the Titanic? Was he the first one off the ship? Like, that I think is what the conclusion that you can potentially come to once you see how he betrays them and he betrays Cooper, because you're like, oh, did this do this to you or were you always that? And I think that's the most interesting question about him as a character.
I think they do, but on the Titanic, it was women, children, and Matt Damon's, right?
Women, children, and cows. Cows.
Okay. Women, first in the boats. Yes.
First in the boats.
I liked that. To backtrack a little bit. Well, actually, no. I'm going to put a mark here. I don't want to backtrack yet. But yeah, I liked that. And then just the delivery of that cold as fuck speech when he thinks Coop is dying. Yeah. And he has this just, oh, I feel sorry for you. Can you hear my voice? And he's trying to give him this weird cold comfort. And he's like, do you see your children? Do you see their faces? And it is fucking unsettling.
Fucked up. And I think, again, it's him being a coward, right? He says, I thought I could see you through this, but I can't. I can't sit here and do this with you. I can't see this happen to you. So it's like, does he take himself to the precipice every time he has to do something hard and immediately realize his own cowardice? That's my conclusion about this character. I think it can go either way. I think you can say that this planet did this to him and all these things, but I think this is this person's character. I think this is his ethos as a person, because he keeps doing these extremely compromising thing. I think this fucker got on the first boat off this planet. Yes. I think he asked people to come save him the second that he could. I think he got the last semblance of hope when they got there and was going to take them for all they were worth. I think he is a coward and that this thing didn't do it to him personally. And I think that's why that speech is so harsh and so, like you said, just unsettling to listen to.
I hope you're listening out there, Matt Damon. We see you. Mackenzie sees you.
We see your shit. Yeah. We see your shit.
From the start. I also love his death is incredible. Like that tense moment. I think we're flashing back to Earth as well as Murph's got some stuff going on there. Not to backtrack too much, but I like
that. The overlay of that is so brilliant. Of those
we're
two
getting
timelines.
These stressful moments. But prior to that, I really like when we transition from they come off the time planet. We see the kids, we see Tom age up in the videos of like, oh shit, we lost a lot of time. And then we finally see Murph. And when her video ends, we cut to her on Earth. I really like that hard cut.
That was a really good cut. Yeah.
Now we're in her shoes and we see what's going on down there.
And we see Professor Brand right there too. And he, time has passed again. Like he has aged, all the things. I think that, again, I think the usage of time here is so well done. This is something that he can do really well. We've seen that. We didn't talk about Inception, but he did it there too, right? Mm-hmm. Like he has been intrigued with time from the beginning of his career. And I think this is just almost the, you know, best example to date of how he really delve deep into that, into how he could play with that. And I think that's a really good cut to your point. And I think you also, part of why we're hopping around is like, you can't tell this story in a linear way because it's not told in a linear way. It's just not. And the things that happen at the beginning impact the things that happen at the end. And like, that's the point of the story. And I think that's what's so interesting about how it's structured.
Well, I got a clean segue for you because we're talking about time. And guess who's out of time? It's Dr. Man. And when he explodes, like, he's in the middle of what he thinks is going to be this powerful, like Apollo 13 or like Neil Armstrong on the moon type speech. And he's just, there comes a moment. And then you get this incredible in space silent explosion. And that just, I love that the music cuts out and you see the heartbreak in their eyes of they think this also means the mission is over. Like now we're doomed. Like humanity is doomed. And I just love that silent explosion and the looks on their faces.
I think it's really well done in a number of ways. I think it's also, it's such a comeuppance for him, but you don't see them treating it that way, right? Like they are trying to stop him because they don't want him to ruin the ship. Don't get me wrong, but you also get the sense that they're trying to talk sense into him and save him as well. So like their motivations seem different, not to say that they're going to forgive this man or whatever. They're probably going to handcuff him to the ship, but they just want to stop him for a number of reasons. And they see, you know, their heart breaks when this happened, etc. But like he's giving this speech and he's so fucking puffed up and condescending and, you know, all the things.
This isn't for me.
This isn't for me. Sure. And it's such a fucking crock of shit. And then the universe blows him up because of it. And it's just, it's like, it's this terrible and satisfying moment of you feel for them and for their heartbreak at what's happening to this ship, but you are like, fuck yeah. Like that guy deserved that, you know?
I do have a question though. I know that at this point in, you know, this dystopia, this made up universe that's parallel to ours, that technology has sort of stopped advancing as much as we would like. But I still feel like with the spaceships we see in this, with the robots we see in this, could they have not made a docking mechanism that worked better than a fucking claw machine at your local bowling alley? I don't get why this is so, it's so fucking hard to dock this thing. Can't they just have the robots do it? It just seems way too difficult.
I think, you know, you got to have a reason to have Cooper. You know what I mean? Like, well, I we got to keep it old school. You know, you got to have a pilot.
If I'm going to play devil's advocate, I guess you could say this, whatever this space station is that's up there has been up there for 100 years or like 70 years. So they're trying to just get something that works with that. It's not as though that has been up there recently, right? Like it's an old space station.
It's older, but like the Lazarus missions are where this came from in theory, right?
Okay, then my point stands. Claw machine. Let's do better, science, NASA.
But like again, think about the reverse of technology. Like that, the Lazarus missions launched when Murphy was born, right? When she was born, they were launched. I think they even say that like the same year that she is born. So this is not that long ago by the time they are encountering the physical technology of that space. So again, I think we are reconstructing technology from the ground up, and NASA is not as advanced as it used to. It simultaneously isn't as advanced because we're rebuilding the tech and the physical things, but we have the science, right? We have the historical science. And so I think it's created this really interesting amalgamation of, we are so much smarter in so many ways, and we have so much data that we never had before, but our physical limitations remain and are arguably worse.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Okay. I think to kind of bring thing, we need to get into sort of the finale, the climax here. You had mentioned the wormhole and the black hole earlier, and the visuals there are just, it's stunning. We don't need to keep harping on how beautiful this movie is. But you also mentioned the spinning dock sequence is pretty thrilling. Like, we know how it's going to end. They're not going to fail, but the way that they keep you on edge and on the edge of your seat there is pretty cool. And then we get into sort of the finale.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can't ignore that, like, there are so many movies where you know exactly what's going to happen and you have no reaction. You know exactly what's going to happen here, yeah. But the visuals and the suspense and the music, again, the score to this, keep you in that question mark, right? Of like, I know how this is going to end, but fuck, it's going to hurt getting there, you know? And they do. And I think you have this real progression of a little bit, again, why I think Dr. Mann always is exactly who he was. You see who Brand is, who Cooper is. Like, they are all fundamentally, they are under extreme circumstances, but they hold true to their the best version of themselves. And yeah. Man's best version sucked, but Cooper's is great and Brand's is great, and they're loyal and they're committed and they're brilliant. And so you see this, you know, once Cooper has sort of accepted his reality, he just goes into problem solving mode, and he sees her as the future and he sacrifices himself for her. And I don't think we can overlook that. But I also think it's another homage to, she was right. She was right about Edmund's planet. And this is another allusion to, like, love being a strong force here, a force that can go beyond science and beyond the data, right? It can tell you that your gut is right about this thing. And she turned out to be right. And they went after Man because of, quote unquote, you know, the data or the what have you. And she ends up being right. And he, I think, knows that in this moment, that she was right and that she should go have a chance. Like, she should go have a chance with Edmund and go build this new planet. And he executes it beautifully and it's shot beautifully. But you get to this black hole and you have no idea what to expect. And that's all shot really. I mean, it's amazing. I love that he's still being kind of a scientist about it. He's narrating it all. He's trying to explain what's happening, you know, in case this all gets back, right? Like, that's such a NASA professional, right? Of like, at the end of the day, I'm here to explore and be a scientist, and I'm going to try and preserve anything and everything. And I just love that, that whole sequence.
If for some reason you're listening to this episode, you've never seen Interstellar, it is like the coolest Microsoft Windows 1995 screensaver you have ever seen. Like, the best, like 10 times better than anything.
I almost spit out my water and I was like, right when I took a drink,
no, you were like, it is trippy. And I like, it's, you know, what is going through a black hole? Look, none of us know. So the creativity that Nolan puts into that, I think, is pretty neat. He could have gone a million directions, like limitless possibilities. And I'm sold on it. By the time we get through that, I'm like, yeah, I guess that could be what it was like. But I wanted to go back like 2 minutes to one moment. For as many moments in this as they dwell on, a lot of moments with Murph and Coop, you know, their conversations there, when she's a kid and they're having this awkward goodbye, she doesn't want to leave. Even the reunion when we get there, there's a lot of moments in this that I feel like we dwell on. Like, we spend a lot of time, the scenes are a minute or two longer than what I think they needed to be, but I think most other filmmakers would be like, okay, let's knock out this boring part and then get back into the spaceships. For as much as we dwell on some of those moments, the one that I don't think we spend enough time on is Coop's sacrifice. And maybe that's to your point. We know he's probably not going to die. But I feel like he kind of, because the music is so loud, we talked last week about Nolan's scores and how he does tend to, the films are very loud. That moment just sort of passes in the blink of an eye, which I don't know how intentional that is, but I feel like they could have taken their time a little more with Coop detaching from the ship.
I think it's supposed to be abrupt. You know, yeah. I think it's supposed to feel unexpected because he has explained it you know, to our limited understanding in a way that you buy, right? Of they're going to use TARS to launch and they're going to have enough momentum and they're going to have enough fuel and all the things. And like, there's no reason, that's not her field, right? She said that at the beginning, that he's there for the science of the ship and the piloting and the things like that. And so I think you can buy the reality that he has calculated it correctly and told her correctly and all the things. So I think this is supposed to be as abrupt for us as it is for her.
Okay.
And, yeah. And I think it lands in that way. I mean, it certainly is. And then to your point about the Microsoft screensaver, you go through this whole wild ride with him. And I think it's really interesting. My one qualm with it, and this is, I'm not trying to be silly. I'm genuinely asking, if you are sacrificing yourself in this scenario, which is what he's doing, and he goes through this black hole and he's thinking, maybe I can get some data, but maybe I can't, whatever. And then he sort of blacks out for a quick second and then he comes to and the eject is, you know, going over and over telling him to eject, eject, eject. Would you fucking eject? Like, would you even really eject in that situation? Because you already think you're dying. The one thing insulating you from space is this spaceship. And even if it's falling apart, it's a shield. It's a shield for you. It's the only shield that you have. Otherwise, it's just you and fucking space in a black hole. And so that is the one moment where I'm like, I'm not, maybe it's so innate. Maybe it's the muscle memory. Maybe it's the pilot of it all of like, yep, it's telling me to eject. I'm going to eject.
If the thing tells you eject, you eject. Yeah.
But I just also wonder, like, would you in that moment actually eject from the one thing keeping you from a black hole?
I mean, he seems resigned to his fate the moment that he decides to detach from the main ship or whatever. So like, maybe it is just maybe it's instinct or maybe it's faith of I've carried myself this far. Let's see where this goes. And he's just taking faith in these things he thinks are beings out there that have been taking care of them so far. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's just a crisis of faith.
I just think he doesn't know the they yet. So that's the thing that makes me question it of like, would you do that? And again, if this is maybe the only protection that you have, would you actually leave it? But I do think part of it can be innate again of like, you're a pilot and it says eject, fucking eject. But it is how he enters this tesseract type of thing and really gets to have access to Murphy. And that is such a ride. I mean, I think we should spend a couple minutes there of like, we already talked about the physical structure of it all and how it was built by the theys and that they can't impact time. Like they can't manufacture the timing of it all. That's why he's here. He's got to impact this space. But I think it's beautifully constructed and shot and it's such an interesting concept. Mm-hmm. And he plays that whole scene really emotionally powerfully. Like really interesting.
Yeah, McConaughey ties it together there. It's another one where I would say that scene goes on a little too long. Like we catch on to what's happening and we're like, okay, he's the ghost. And then it keeps, there's still like 8 more minutes or 10 more minutes within this setting. So I'm fine with it. I do like where it gets us, you know, when he eventually sort of exits out of there. And then you kind of have to wrap your head around the fact that now, you know, he's jumped forward in time. They've found him. But we do get this incredible reunion with Murph. I think that's super touching, just to see her grown up and with all her family and their goodbye. I think that's like I said, this whole movie, for as much as it's about the downfall of humanity, is more about just this dynamic between this father-daughter. So I think that last moment delivers.
I think it is this... I think it's that love between a father and daughter, absolutely, that care that carries the story. But I also think it's that human connection, again, of like we can fail in so many ways and we can betray people in so many ways. And our hubris and our Perseus of it all can burn us at the end of the day. But what is truly human, what is the indisputable part of our nature is rooted in our need for connection and love with each other. And you see that in the room full of people and the family she's created and the world that she saved and that he contributed to. And yeah, I think it closes a chapter, but it also creates a new chapter for him and gives him a second chance to live the life that he sort of sacrificed to go do this thing. But it is, I think, really bittersweet that he's missed her life. I don't think you can overlook that part.
if they hadn't had a chance to reconnect yet, but the fact that they have this like very, like you said, somber moment of, you know, she knew all along that he was the ghost, and like they had this like connection, even though he was nowhere near her, and sort of she figured out what was going on. And then she has a couple really good lines of, I knew you would come back because my dad promised me. I think that one's really good. And then when she says, you know, no parent should have to watch their child die, I'm gonna make my grandkids watch me die instead. You go away.
But I struggle. I think it's beautiful and it's poetic. She does basically say that. I do think it's beautiful and poetic in a lot of ways. I do struggle with that scene a little bit, though, because I wonder too, as a father, like he is a relentless explorer, right? Like we see that. That's what he decides to do. And I love that for him. I love that about his character. I think it's a perfectly admirable trait, desire, destiny, all the things.
However, I like ending on him going to find Brand. I think that's a great ending to the story.
I think so too, but I think it can wait is what I'm saying. Okay. That's my one. I think that would be my one criticism of he has time, you know, he does. I mean, like we keep coming back to time. He has time. He's 124, but he's actually 35. Right. Mm-hmm. So he has time to, she is dying, you know, she is dying. And that probably won't take long from the state of her. Right. And so I just think if maybe, and I'm not a parent, but I just think if that's my kid, I don't care if they look, they're 50 years older than me at this time or whatever it is. If that's my kid whose life I missed most of, I would want to be with them for every second that I had. I think, I don't know. I don't think it's a bad choice. I just think I would question that a little bit.
I mean, it's McConaughey. Maybe there was a UT game the next day and his daughter gave him the all clear. So he was like, okay, you sure? I'll see you later. Hook him.
Oh my God. That is also a great point though, of like the daughter gave the all clear, but is it one of those where it's like, you can go, but they're actually like, I want you to stay, you know? I don't know.
It's a unique situation. They've literally teamed up to save the world. So I don't know how that would play out. If it's just like, hey, we did everything. We bonded together. We saved humanity. I'm good. See you later. Love you.
I do like that she tells him to go on this last adventure. I also like that he kind of goes rogue to do it. I like that it's going to help Brand, who again, I think he's acknowledged at this point is super brilliant, obviously as well, and read this room really well and has maybe found the right planet and is ready to, you know, is one of the right people to lead this effort. And there's this implication that he's going to go help her literally repopulate this planet. And I think it is a really poetic and beautiful ending. And I think they really bonded in a way. And you even see that again in the black hole situation where like he's touching her hand, like he's her mm-hmm. ghost as well. And so all these tie-ins become really beautiful at the end. So I do like that part of the story for him. I feel like it could, you know, even with a flash forward, we don't got to see it, but I just think he could be with his daughter a little longer. It's to me really sad that it's so brief, you know, that's all.
Fair point.
I also think that it's fun to mention here that I do think there are romantic implications for him and Brand at this point. And even if only based on the first iteration of the script, where they had actually already been intimate at this point and he goes to find her. And like, so that part stays the same, but there like is a romantic connection there as well.
I actually like it better without it. I think it shows more the respect he has for her and like the dream they can achieve together if he's going out there without, you know, having to tie back into the whole love theme. I think it actually is a better ending for him to just find somebody, a partner and a scientific genius that he respects out there in the universe.
Hmm. I think they're still going to repopulate the new Earth though.
Hell yeah, like, they are.
Okay, so anyway, we've just like fangirled over this movie for a couple hours. I think it's really fascinating. I think there are so many layers to this. Like you could go on and on and on about it for a really long time, but I think it's worth, you know, several watches. I've watched it many times and I still get something different from it every time. I think it's really, really fascinating if you haven't watched it yet. So anyways, what is your rating?
First off, I can't get Matthew Hathaway McConaughey out of my head now.
Oh my God.
And their kids. Just anyway. I wanted to call out two things we didn't have time to touch on. I think Tom, for as much as I originally thought he was sort of put on the back burner, I do like how they incorporate him into the story. I think the performances by Chalamet's okay. He's young here, but I think Affleck really crushes his part, and him holding out hope for his dad longer than he thought that Murph did. And eventually, you know, losing a daughter to this, and that line that Murph has where she's like, are you waiting for another one of your kids to die? That fuck.
Oof,
the usage of Tom is great for as much as he's not focused on. My last thing was like, is there a version of this movie that works without the Michael Caine twist of like, we knew Earth was dying? Could you have made this work without saying there was no hope for Earth and this was just a mission to go?
No, because I think he's the one who would discover that, right? Like, I mean, for them to know that they have no hope in this particular scenario requires him. He's the science behind it at that point. Again, there are not a bazillion engineers and scientists and all these things. Like, he's the guy figuring out that calculation. So for Dr. Mann to know that, even if we wanted to put that on Mann, for Mann to know that, he had to have known that, you know?
Okay. So I didn't love that when it first came out of his mouth again this time. I'm like, dude, you were going to die in like literally 60 seconds. You couldn't just shut the fuck up to let Murph live out the rest of her life in blissful ignorance. And I guess maybe that is what inspires her to go and solve the problem.
I was going to say, I think it had to happen, you know, because then I think she comes back to like, it's on me. I have to solve it. I can't wait for my dad to solve it. She uncovers that he is going to help her. But the reason she looks harder at it is she's like, I can't wait for him to come back and save us. That's the impetus for her to take full ownership. I think it has to happen that way.
Good point. Yeah. Okay. You got me on board. I think that's everything I had. And then the last thing I had to call out was, I know you're not a big horror fan. Have you ever seen Event Horizon with Lawrence Fishburne? Mm-mm. So horror movie from like late 90s, early aughts, Sam Neill, Lawrence Fishburne, but they use kind of the same tech and they go through a wormhole and he does the exact same visual metaphor of taking a piece of paper, drawing dots on it, connecting it together, running a pencil through it, making a hole. So I just thought I saw that and was like, that's fucking Event Horizon. So I don't know if that was an intentional nod. It's a decent horror movie, but anyway.
I read that it was actually.
Okay.
That it's the exact same concept.
I mean,
was used in both.
I don't think there's any harm in it. I'm not saying, you know, as long as it's knowledge.
Well, I think it's, again, it's rooted in the science, you know, like that's what it's based on. So.
Okay. All that to say, since I've gone on for 6 more minutes than I was supposed to, I will say I really, really like this. I thought the first time through, I was like, it was fine. The second time through, I liked it more. So I would say after a second watch, I would probably bump this up to like 8.5. I really enjoyed it. The first watch, I would probably have given it like an 8, 7.5, because I needed to see it a second time to really understand everything that was happening. But I'd go up to like 8.5 now.
Yeah, I think it's like an 8.5 or a 9, you know, probably an 8.5, because I don't think it's perfect. And I don't love the miss with him and Murphy at the end personally. But I actually loved the question about the adjective here of like, I do think when I think about this film, I do think it's stunning, both again, from the performances, the visuals, the music, it's an experience, the tension that it creates, all those things. I just think it's a very, very strong showing, and I understand why people can be deterred by how complicated it is, especially on a first watch. I see why people maybe don't think it's one of his best necessarily, or maybe are just think it's too intense to watch. But I, to your point, I think if you watch it again and again, like, you start to get more from it, and then you can appreciate the things that you maybe overlooked in your confusion. So I think that's one of the interesting layers of this one for sure. Mm. All right, friends. Well, thanks for joining. November. That was our last one.
That was a fun month.
What a ride.
Fun month. Yeah.
That was a fun month. We've had a couple good ones in a row, man. This has been a good time. I'm about to have a great fucking time, though, because we're about to start a whole new month. And y'all have been waiting for it, and y'all have heard me lobby for it, and we are finally here. Lamar is going to sit through a month of musicals. He is going to watch a month of musicals. I think that's my Christmas present. I didn't get like a ton of anniversary presents. I think I'm getting Christmas presents from you.
That's exactly what it was planned. I was going to wrap it up and put it in a box, but now you've uncovered it early, so I won't bother. Yeah. And for the record, I have no problem with musicals. I think I just haven't seen that many of them. I think we're covering one.
Well, we're going to find out if he has problems with musicals is what we're going to learn. I am excited, though, because we have a good range, I think, this month. Mm-hmm. We're going to have some fun ones. And we're going to start things off with Funny Girl, a la Barbra Streisand. Like, it's we're going to kick off with a bang, is what I would say.
Her first film, right? Debut film for Streisand?
Her debut film. Not her debut as an actress. She was already on Broadway for quite a while at this point. And actually, the original had been on Broadway several years prior. It was 64, and this came out in 68. So, and she originated the role on Broadway as well. So, yeah, it's a fun one to start with. It's a good one. So, come back and listen to that one. But in the meantime...
follow us on our socials. We drink and we watch things, Instagram, TikTok, all the things. You can get the video of this podcast on YouTube or Spotify video. And you can always email us. We drink and we watch things pod@gmail.com with movie suggestions, theme suggestions, questions, all that good stuff.
Indubitably. All right, kids, for now, go have a drink.
And finally, I would say that we are probably planning to do FanJan again. So keep an eye on the Instagram, because we might be looking for some movie suggestions for you guys, running some votes there to figure out what movies we should do in January. Trying to get ahead of it this time so we can time the vote.
We still have a bunch that we haven't done, but I think we can always use more for sure. Yes. All right, kids. Well, for now, go have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers.